Hello and welcome to Bonus Bookworms. I'm your host, Alex.
Seriously, you sound like a tool. I'm Joe.
Suck the wind right out of this episode, you piece of shit. This is great. We're having a good time. Anyway, this is the show.
Sorry, we just got done telling Alex how he needs to get a haircut. He's looking like a... I don't even know what anymore. Very emo.
Because tonight will be the night that I will fall for you. Yeah, that's basically what I look like, yeah.
The black jacket. I mean, granted, I get it's a sunapee jacket, but it's the black clothes, the long hair. It's not a good look, Alex.
It works for me. I'm feeling my look, you know?
You're feeling emo? You love to hate the world?
Yeah, I'm in my 30s now, so I obviously have to do what's, was cool for me back in 2007 when I was a teenager. So it's like this was the look.
Yeah,
I gotta do it with my nails though.
Yeah, the black nail polish.
Yeah, so Bookworms is a show all about mid-2000s fashion tips and styles.
So yeah, this is a bonus episode. Listener request, even. So this is something new and different. This book was requested by a person that has been, I guess, listening from day one. They said the title sounded interesting, and when I looked into it, it was highly recommended by Stephen King. So I said, sure, let's go for it. The book is called The Greatest Thing Since Sliced Bread by Don Robertson.
Yeah, if you want your book to sell well, make sure Stephen King has a pull quote on the cover for you. That'll move some copies. And he's not wrong about this one, so we'll get into this. This is quite the treat. It's kind of marketed as a lost American classic. It's
really cool. Stephen King basically said this is what got him interested into writing. So I mean, that's got to be something. Right?
Well, yeah. A couple hundred million copies later.
Yeah, so what is this book about? Well, nothing about sliced bread, I can tell you that. So the back of the jacket says, on a quiet autumn afternoon in 1944, 9-year-old Morris Bird III decides to visit a friend who lives on the other side of town. He grabs the handle of his red wagon and, with his little sister in tow, begins an incredible pilgrimage across Cleveland and out of childhood forever. Set against the backdrop of one of the worst industrial disasters in American history, Don Robertson's enduring beloved masterwork is a remarkable story of destiny, bravery, and responsibility, as fresh and relevant as when it first appeared in print. So we read this book. I read this well before Alex did, because Alex has been slow reading.
Yeah, this book's 211 pages, and it took me like 3 weeks to get through.
Yeah,
that might sound like I don't like it, but I actually really enjoyed this one. This was a fun book to read.
If you look at Alex's Goodreads, he has not been reading much at all this year. I'm a little worried about him, because was it a couple of years ago you read like 100-something books?
Yeah.
And this year you're starting off slow with like 6.
Yeah, I had a couple of years there where I was reading over 100 books a year. Last year, though, like I just fell off a cliff. I read, I think, like 60, which is still a really good number.
Which is about what I typically read on a good year.
Considering the average adult reads about 0 books a year, I think 60 is a really good number. I don't know why you're giving me such a hard time about it.
I'm just a little worried about you, Alex. That's all. You said usually you're about double that, and you all of a sudden, and so this year you're on track of doing like, I don't know, like 40 books. I mean, and these are short books you're reading here. These aren't exactly the long tomes that our other co-host will sometimes read.
Yeah. The big issue is I have emo hair now, so it's in my eyes and I can't read.
Yeah, the emo hair is a problem with your sight.
Yeah, I'd push it out of my eyes, but that would ruin the illusion that I'm totally emo, bro. I'd look preppy. I can't have that.
Yeah. So I said it was a fun read. It was definitely a good recommendation. Moving on now.
Yep, that's the episode back.
So, what is this book about, Alex? Where do we start?
This book is what we call in the literary world a coming-of-age story about a young boy named Morris Byrd III, a young child growing up in World War II-era Cleveland. And he's got something to prove to himself.
Yeah. So, yeah, we start off with kind of a foreshadowing. It's all in italicized here. I'll read the opening couple paragraphs, if that's all right with you, Alex.
Oh, please.
The luckless man was wise enough to understand that heroes can be found in the damnedest places, which was why he didn't hesitate when he called the boy the greatest thing since sliced bread. For the boy...
Can I pause that? What a great opening paragraph that is, too. Like, really draws you in, doesn't it? It's like, it kind of... Like, he's not starting in the beginning and going linearly. He starts at the end with this, and, like, because there's a bit of a build-up to what actually happens. So, like, this is a great literary technique where you start at the end to show, like, hey, something's going to happen. Yeah. And then it draws you in and makes you want to find out what happens.
Mm-hmm. For the boy, though, the big thing wasn't his bravery. As far as he was concerned, too much fuss was made over it. For the boy, the big thing happened before the explosion. It happened at the moment he saw his old buddy Stanley Chalupka. The exact moment. Why? Because it meant that the boy had accomplished what he had set out to do. So yeah, as I said, you know, some big... Basically tells you that the end of the story there without actually telling you anything at all, but... You know, that's kind of what foreshadowing does. And like you said, it was, you know, letting you know that, hey, yeah, he's going to accomplish this big deed. And as most heroes usually act, he's like, oh, I just did my thing. And I don't know why everyone's calling me a hero, even though people are saying that, no, you did something really great. You know? Alex is giving me a confused look.
Yeah, sorry. I'm hearing like a buzzing in my ears. Bzzz. It's not that. It's like a high-pitched thing. Hope it doesn't come through on the recording. Anyway, we can move in. We'll have to deal.
Yep.
All right. So yeah, it's a really good literary technique. You see it in a billion books with just having like a hint towards, or it's called foreshadowing. Obviously, it leads you to want to find out what happens. Especially in books that tend to need a lot of setup or have slower starts. You usually start at the end or in the middle, and then. Carry on from there. My own book, Paul Plimpton versus Ragnarok, does just that too, because it starts right at the end and then goes back to the beginning, and he's reliving his life, flashing before his eyes.
Good job selling your own book, Alex. You'll sell another 1.5 copies, hopefully.
Yeah, I actually said something positive about it. It's a new edition of it out now too.
Ooh,
yeah,
sexy.
Yeah, it's got a.
You corrected all the spelling mistakes that you could find.
All the typos are gone, and I rearranged the text so it's in justified format rather than left-hand aligned. It looks really fancy, smanty.
There you go. Go out, buy Alex's books. Yeah. Book. You took the rest of them down still, right?
Yeah, those are still down. Working on it.
Out of print.
Out of print. If you have a copy of
It's probably out worth of print millions.
Books, yeah.
Probably worth millions.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys know this. I'm kind of a big deal.
In his own mind.
But we're not talking about Paul Plimpton. We're talking about Morris Byrd III.
So we get into Morris Byrd III. And I do have a question here, Alex. What was the point of... Basically, Morris, every time he refers to himself, because it's in his view in the whole book, or most of the book, he always refers to himself by his full name. Is that something that, you know, some literary thing? Or is that just, you know, what's going on with that?
I think that is just part of him as a character, part of his build. Obviously, when you're the third in like a line of names, there's obviously some pride associated with that. So I think he's 9 years old in the book, and we find out really early on he's looking for something about himself that he can be proud of, something that he...
Yeah, he feels like he's done a lot of cowardly things in his short life so far, and he's trying to find a way to prove that he's not a coward.
Yeah, so I think calling himself Morris Byrd III, it gives him that ownership over that name. It gives him that family lineage. That's something he can be proud of. Also, it's like it's a silly thing, like Morris Byrd III. It's got that kind of silly rhyme. It's something that he gets kind of sometimes lightly made fun of for in the book. And referring to himself as Morris Byrd III also kind of takes back that making fun of, gives him ownership that he's not ashamed of having a silly name like that.
So I'm going to read another quote here in the beginning of the book, if you don't mind, Alex.
Yes.
It's where Morris and his friend Suzanne, which, by the way, people, Suzanne is one of Alex's favorite female names in the world.
Okay.
You told me this, you know, I don't know, probably 10 years ago, 15 years
Suzanne?
Ago. Suzanne? Suzanne.
You got a better memory than I do. Yeah, I read the name Suzanne in this book, and that's why it took me 3 weeks, because they threw it out my window. Yeah. I was like, And then I had to,
But Morris and Suzanne, a friend, are having a conversation. Morris likes Suzanne, but she's always way too serious for him. And he's a serious kind of boy, but you know, his seriousness versus a girl's seriousness are very different things, which is, you know, there's a big distinction, you know, he makes a big distinction between boys and girls in this book. We'll get into that later probably, but here's the quote. "You ever think of scary things?" she asks him one day. "What kind of things?" "Scary things, dumbhead. Like having babies." "I'm not going to have any babies," said Morris Byrd III. Suzanne Wysocki made a fist. "Now be serious." Quickly he nodded. He didn't like it when people were angry with him. "All right," he said. She opened the hand. "Good," she said. She looked at the hand, and then she looked at the trees. What I mean is, you know, being alone and having no one to run to, doing things on your own, growing up, getting married, having babies, getting old, dying. Dying? Like Mr. Pisani? Yes. I don't think much about dying. You should, said Suzanne. Why? Because it's going to happen to you. Oh, said Morris Byrd III. Big deal. You know what my brother Frank used to say? No. When I was little, sometimes I'd cry, you know, over nothing. The way little kids do. If Frank was around, he'd come to me, and you know what he'd say? He'd grin at me and say, now, honey. Don't get so worked up. It's all going to be over soon enough. Just think. You're 24 hours closer to dying than you were at this time yesterday. So I just thought that was kind of funny. I set a kind of a tone for the book of, I said, the level of seriousness between the two of them. And
it's like the conversation that really sets off Morris Byrd III on his journey to do something with himself before he dies, accomplish some sort of feat, because he never really thought of death before that. Mm. And then all of a sudden, that's like the thing on his mind, like, I got to do something.
Yeah, what am I going to do before I die? I got limited time, and every 24 hours, it's that much closer.
Yeah, thank God.
Can you imagine that, Alex, thinking that way?
It weighs heavily on you, but like 9 years old also, it's like you think very literally, like this is a big deal to him.
Yeah, I mean, think back to when you're 9 years old. Did you ever really think about death? I mean, yeah, even if, say, you had a family member, like a grandparent or, you know, distant relative die, it didn't really affect you, you know, the same way as it does, as, you know, people, what is it, you know, 20s and 30s or, you know, even their 60s and 70s these days. Where it's like, you know, all of a sudden, yeah, that just weighs on you all the more. It's at that age, it's always, oh, that's somebody else. That's not going to be me. I'm going to live forever.
Yeah, I mean, we all have those. We all have different, like, first experiences with death. I think normally it's when you lose, you know, a loved one of some sort, or even if it's just a pet, or, you know, I think I was probably about the age of Morris when, like, our papa died. Like, that was like that first experience, and you set it's like, oh, okay, these things do come to an end, and then you're gone forever. I had a very different reaction. I was not like, I need to live every day like it's my last, I need to accomplish things. It was just more, you know, just realizing, like, coming to terms with that fact rather than needing to prove myself at 9 years old. That might be a little more just the author kind of inserting. It's like, oh, this guy thinks a little bit different because he's thinking about death, and he's thinking he needs to prove to the world who he is before he's gone.
Yeah, I think back when Papa died, and I guess other than being like really bored at the funeral, I didn't really give it much thought. I mean, you know, this is someone, you know, in the summers we go to his lake house and go swimming in, you know, the lake, and in the winters after skiing, go to his house and watch Cartoon Network, which we did not have when we were real little like that. And but yeah, so yeah, I didn't really. Otherwise, I didn't really give it much thought.
Yeah, it's just more something you like notice as you go along. Like, oh, this person's not here.
This, as you said, this book kind of drags a little bit in the beginning. It's very redundant. Maybe is the right word.
Yeah, I'd say it gets a little bit rambly. We got to, like, he spends a probably a little too long setting up the quest that Morris gives himself, because he's got to introduce a bunch of different characters. He's got to...
Yeah, we get introduced to was it Stanley and the sister and the grandmother.
Yeah.
And a few other friends that don't really make huge appearances in the books, but they're needed for his initial getting moving.
Yeah, he's got some friends who, yeah, they give him some tools that help him as he goes along and later in the book. But yeah, a lot of it's just setting up, like,
it's very hero questy. You know, you'll need this at some point, and you might need this at some point. And
Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah. And like the whole the setting up of why he needs to prove that he needs to improve himself essentially to be brave. And basically we find out a little bit later in the book that he did a couple of cowardly things, but the big one that's weighing on his mind was he got another kid expelled for something he did.
Yeah, it was a simple
threw a rotten mistake. Sandwich on the teacher's or principal's car.
It was a sandwich he didn't want to eat. He just threw it away. Didn't really look where it went. And it got stuck on a teacher's car. And it became a way bigger deal than he would have thought that might sound.
Yeah. Basically, a kid gets expelled for it just because he was the troublemaker in the class. And
the teacher was trying to, like, string out this kid to be an example. And that kid, he wasn't confirming or denying. So they kept saying, he did it. And even after they expelled him, like, he never confessed. So Morris got away with it. However, he feels guilty because he did not have the courage to come forward and admit what he did.
Yeah, so he just say he ends up deciding he's going to go see, you know, go across town and see his friend who moved away, because this is World War II and basically things are getting scarce because we're in total war and people just can't, you know.
And it's like Cleveland, you know, a big, like, industrial city. So, like, everything is geared towards the war effort.
Yeah. And a lot of the fathers are off serving or doing something for the war, so they're not around very often. Morris's dad is around because he's a radio personality, so he's doing propaganda stuff for America. And so he's around, but he's not really around because he's working so many hours. But the friend is his father gets shipped away, and the mom can't afford the house they're living in, so she has to move to a cheaper part of town, get the grandmother, I think it's the grandmother living with them to afford the house while the dad's away. And
yeah, and that's something that's, like, really well done in the book, is like Morris's dad is essentially an unseen character, but you still get that established father-son relationship and that distance between them, like, especially, like, this, like, towards right before the explosion happens, like, they hear their dad on the radio, and, like, Morris and his sister have been fighting the entire book, but then they hear their dad and they realize that they have that common, I guess, almost trauma between them, where their dad is a distant person from them, and it brings them together.
And Stanley, Morris's friend, is another one of those ones where his relationship with his father is strange but really well portrayed, where his dad was, like, high school football captain, this big guy, and Stanley is this uber geek train nerd, and he's got the train sets in the basement all set up, but you find out that his dad is all for it. He's like, hey, whatever my kid's into, I want to help him out. Super smart kid, basically could end up being a doctor or a lawyer or whatever he wants. Well, the dad's basically just a typical jock, but the dad said, where you normally would see a dad like that, kind of almost abusive towards their kind of wimpy son, this dad embraced it.
Yeah, family dynamics are always, like, on the outskirts of this book. It's a really cool thing. It's, like, a very masterful thing. It's almost like a side quest, like, just, like, setting up those relationships with your family, while his main thing is trying to prove to himself that he's worth something. because he's kind of on his own, because he's like, you know, he's like the only boy in the house, and he's got to find out what it means to be a man on his own. And I gotta say, meeting Stanley Chalupka in the might be my favorite part of the first half of the book. Don Robertson does a great job of making Stanley this just like quirky, nerdy, really strange, really likable character, and you can see why Morris Byrd III really likes him, because Morris is more athletic, like he's good academically, but he's big into baseball, he's got lots of friends, he's your average all-American boy, and Stanley's this huge turbo nerd, and Morris is his only friend. And yet you can see why Morris is drawn to Stanley, because Stanley is so just interesting as a character. Like, we meet him when he's intentionally throwing a spelling bee that he is.
Yeah, because this girl wildly is overqualified for being a sore loser, but you can tell Stanley kind of has the huts for her, and he throws the spelling bee, even though everyone can see that he should win it. And he had won the math challenge the week or the day before, hands down over this girl. And most of the class hated this girl because she's just one of those know-it-all snobby girls. But it says Stanley kind of saw something in her, and he's like, hey, I can let her win this and make her day and maybe get her to notice me. And even though it doesn't work out that way, but he still feels like he did something good. And Morris kind of comes to terms with it, like, hey, he threw this, but it was for a noble reason. Morris always brings everything back to being brave and being noble and doing the right thing. That's definitely the major theme that's just beaten into your head in this book.
Yeah, he's really finding out like what it means to be human. you can tell they kind of like beat you over the head with it, because we keep coming back to those themes while we're talking about it. But yeah, the thing that I think you mentioned earlier was the thing that stirs the quest is Stanley moves across town, and Morris wants to go visit him, and he figures the best way he can prove that he's a brave person is to go off on his own and find his friend.
Yeah, so he plans this out meticulously, and he figures out exactly his route to get there so he can avoid being stopped. He figures out what day to do it on so that he's not missed from school or from his house. He figures out what exactly he needs between just supplies and whatever. And then he gets to the day, and the only thing that screws him up is his sister. Little sister decides she's going to go along, or she's going to rat him out.
Yeah, so he's forced to bring his sister, Sandra. Luckily, Fortune kind of helps him out. He sees his friend. He's got
another red wagon.
A red wagon they have this like funny little secret language where they talk backwards. So the red wagon, the Crimson Streak. I just sketched out the Crimson Streak, or the Nosmerk Carts, as they keep calling it throughout the book.
Kind of obnoxious, but
yeah, it got a little obnoxious. I was like, am I saying it right? And I'm like, this is just a bullshit made up thing. Anyway, his friend loans him his wagon for 50 cents, and he's able to kind of use that to haul his sister and all his supplies down the road as he goes along. He brings an alarm clock. All of his money, which is like 7 cents after the rental.
Yeah, he had a little bit more than that, but it was like, I think, like under $5. Yeah. Which, at the time was still a fair amount of money, but it's not enough to really, like, if he got into some real trouble, to get him out of it.
Yeah, and then he also brings a jar of peanut butter, which winds up being probably the most important thing that he brings with him.
He also has a knife with him, just in case.
Oh, yeah, because of the evil pen knife.
Yeah. And another big character in this story building up to it is his grandmother, who had moved in, and basically him lying to her about hiding on going on this trip, and how he's like trying to justify his lying and how doing this mission he's getting himself will offset that lying.
Yeah, he's like, he knows he's doing the wrong thing by lying to his grandmother, but he's going to make it all right by doing this act of bravery.
Yeah, so he goes on this trip. He has to basically drag his sister in this wagon the whole way because she can't walk that far. She's a few years younger than him. And
it gets about 100 pages or so. It gets a little episodic. He has some run-ins as he makes his way across town. First thing he comes across is a riot.
Yeah, which basically it's over cigarettes, one of the local markets, packy store type things. Get their order of cigarettes in, and because that was one of those things that got rationed out during World War II. All the people that are addicted to cigarettes are lining up because they can only get so many, and once they're gone, they're gone. And there he meets his former nanny, who was a prostitute.
Yeah, and he's so there's like people fighting all around, and he's just sort of like there, and he's worried mostly about someone asking him why he's not in school at that moment. And
he's also kind of hinting that his sister's awfully brave for not ratting him out, yeah, because she could have easily done that.
Yeah, so he doesn't involve himself too much with that. He manages to get around it. I think that whole thing was just, I think, setting up the scene a little bit with it, you know, being like, showing it like, this is World War II era Cleveland. Yeah. This is what it was like. So we're just getting that kind of almost
we're going from, he's a middle class, upper middle class type family. And as we go through the book, he's going into worse and worse parts of town. So this is like the first step down where you're going from middle class to working class or working poor type people.
Yeah, and this is almost like one of those like road stories that you might see where it's like we're the ones sitting in the wagon while we're being taken through town, and there's this like whole pastoral scene of, I guess not pastoral because it's a city, but this whole scene of us being like, this is what it looked like in that time, and this is how people would have behaved, this is how people would have acted, and so like we're getting the tour of the scene with Morris as he's pulling us through on his journey.
Yeah, I know it's been a long time since I read this one. Thanks, Alex. But he ends up, I think the next area, kind of getting into the black neighborhoods, but you don't realize he's in the black neighborhoods with the way Don Robertson writes this book. Also, throughout each section of the book, we're getting kind of backstories on other people. You know, just it's like, you know, this almost confusing jumping to these other people that you're like, you know they're going to be involved somehow, but you're not really sure. You're getting some of their background detail.
Yeah, we get like these little vignettes. There's a football game going on. There's a lady who's just like working in her house. Mm. There's a man with no legs playing music.
Yeah, a guy dies of a heart attack, that sort of stuff. But as the story moves on, each of them gets introduced into Morris's story somehow.
Yeah, it all starts like it starts with these like little like clips, the little vignettes of their lives, and it's sort of like when you watch a movie and like it has all the different characters like cuts between them, and as their stories start to converge, it all like merges into one complete cohesive unit.
Yeah. I did notice that there was a lot of attention put on, I think her name is Brooke, the woman that's having the affair with the neighbor. And, you know, it was getting into some pretty detailed stuff there. I kind of felt a little uncomfortable, like maybe the author was trying to say something there. But
you blushing all of a sudden?
Pretty much. She was definitely the most popular one out of all these side stories, like going into the most detail on her inner thoughts. And it was a lot of more, not dirty, but definitely higher rated than the rest of the stories for sexual content.
Well, everyone loves like a little bit of sex in their story.
Just saying, it was like compared to all the other side stories, she was definitely front and center. Yeah.
So this book came out in the 60s. Gratuitous sex was like a new thing.
So eventually Morris makes it into the black neighborhoods, even though he never expressly really says it, other than the black lady who saves him. Basically, he was it the sister plays hopscotch with these kids.
They were playing jacks.
Jacks, yeah. And then they find these kids skipping school, throwing around a football.
And Morris loses their ball.
Yeah,
for them.
He kicks punched the ball, and it ends up in the back of a dump truck.
And they
start beating him up.
Wail on him.
Yeah, and this black lady and in an electric car, which was like, you know, I'm reading this and it's like 2023 is like, oh, we're pushing electric cars out. This is about 60 years ahead of its time. Holy crap. But yeah, they make this big deal about this woman's car, like this really weird car, like what the hell is this thing? But she comes out, chases the boys off, and basically saves Morris from a beating and his quest failing right there. And
yeah, she really like manages to like bring him back from that, because
he was about ready to give up there. That was probably one of his lowest points.
Yeah, because he He's getting beat up.
He's falling behind his schedule. Yeah.
He lost something for these people. Yeah. And he's just feeling like oh, I'm not going to achieve this quest. This is like it's part of the hero's journey. He's at his lowest point here. And she builds him back up. This complete stranger talks to him and brings out all the honesty in him that he's able to be open with her. Yeah. He even gives her the remainder of his money so that they can buy a football if they don't get it back from the truck that he kicked it into and all these things. And he's able to do the right thing on his own, which is really nice.
Around this section, I realized something. Morris is obsessed with baseball. And
it's 1940s Cleveland. What else are you going to do?
Yeah, well, I was thinking, I grew up loving baseball, but even in the 90s, baseball was really pretty much what you get now, only maybe a little bit more so.
Steroids.
Yeah, more steroids, bigger guys. But back in the 40s and even in the 60s, baseball was really different. It was there was a lot more leagues. It wasn't just the Major League Baseball. There were the colored leagues, the white leagues. There were professional leagues, multiple professional leagues, a lot of semi-pro leagues. Everybody... you had the Sandlot leagues. Everyone was playing everybody. It was
the everyman game.
Yeah.
It's a great game because it's not too physically demanding, or at least it wasn't. It's become something kind of almost cruel monster of itself.
Yeah, it's all statistics now. We're back in the day. It was
a fun game.
You get a group of people together and you just had a pickup game. It didn't matter. Yeah.
Hang out for 2 to 4 hours and play a nice long game, and it's fun to watch. It's got a nice slow beauty to it, but now it's all statistics and $200 million contracts.
Yeah, but yeah, so I said, knowing enough about the history of baseball, I was like, hey, this is a lot much more bigger cultural reference to our nation than we would pick up nowadays. And so one of those things that just kind of gets probably lost in translation for a lot of people, especially younger readers that would be reading this that don't know a lot of that background information.
Yeah, was how you brought people together. It still is in a lot of ways, but it was very different than, tailgating and partying. It used to be you go play with your friends. You play, you get 18 of your friends and you go play a baseball game.
Yeah, or you get 9 of your friends and you go play your worst enemies, because that was kind of, what they did. They had serious rivalries going on where you just... you went into someone else's neighborhood and said, "We challenge you to a game," and it was like the whole neighborhood showed up, and people would get stabbed if you didn't play well enough. All of a sudden,
yeah, it's this beautiful little snapshot of American history when they make references like that.
Yeah, but that basically leads us to the culmination of this book, the big explosion.
So he starts doing a lot more leading into this shit's about to go down, guys. He starts pointing out these are gas tanks that aren't properly sealed and everyone swore by them.
Yeah, we get a lot of detail how safe it is, but then what they kind of forgot to realize on how to store propane, and people are smelling this weird smell and no one's really thinking much about it, even though there's these giant propane tanks in the...
Yeah, fumes start leaking out of the propane tanks and it spreads all around. This is actually based on a real event. This actually happened, this gas explosion in 1944 Cleveland that killed, 136 people.
Something like that. What I appreciate with this is Morris Bird III gets all the way there, sees his friend on his front porch. They wave to each other. Then the explosion happens and Stanley just is gone. He just dies. No drawn out anything. And basically Morris, this is such a catastrophic thing. Morris can't even comprehend that, hey, my friend just vaporized. He's just like, I don't know what happened, but I don't have time to think about what happened.
Yeah, so he finally achieves his quest. And I'm not going to read this whole thing, but this is also a really cool stylistic thing he does just on the page. For really the rest of the book, while things are so chaotic, he just abandons paragraphs.
Yeah, it's just all just giant massive
blocks of text. And he's just jumping from subject to subject. And why do you think he does that, Joe?
I don't know. I was going to kind of question you since you're the literate person here. You went to college for this sort of thing.
Well, I'm also an educator. I'm asking you.
I learned how to count bugs, essentially, and look at trees. So you're the one that read books up in college.
All right. So, yeah, he's doing this because he's creating a scene of... He's trying to show the chaos that is happening on the page. So there's all these characters. This woman's just had her eyelids melted down onto her face. This guy gets blown out of his house, and he's on fire. And Stanley erupts into flame, and all these things are happening. Buildings are all of a sudden exploding. People are getting vaporized, and it's all just pure chaos. So he's using the text stylings, and he's writing it in this way to mimic that sort of chaos on the page, where there's no real just logic or reason to his writing. It's just more like this is all happening all at once. But yeah, I'm gonna read just maybe a few sentences of it because it just like it just jumps all around. Casimir Redlich knew he had been maybe too abrupt with poor Irving Bernstein, but what would have been gained by beating around the bush? No matter how you slice such news, it was bound to come as a shock. The way Casimir Redlich saw it, he hadn't really had much of a choice. He wheeled himself into the front room. He was just placing his trumpet to his lips, where he was blown through the front of his house. The next thing he knew, he was sitting in the middle of the street. His shirt was on fire, and he was still holding his trumpet. He beat out his shirt and looked around. His house was gone. His mouth was open, and he did believe he was screaming, but he could hear nothing. Up the street, Stanley Chalupka was enveloped in a smear of flame and incinerated on the spot. So was his mother, who had been standing in the kitchen. His grandmother, Mrs. Ava Sucks, was crushed to death by a roof beam that fell across her bed and cut her in two. Over in the Hall of Armor in the Museum of Art, a Miss Helene K. Dallas was berating a boy named Theodore Karam for allegedly attaching, with the aid of chewing gum, a note saying, Serolad Osavab Sknitz. Oh, why did I choose to read that? On the back of a coat worn by a girl named Dolores Bavasso. Not that Mrs. Dallas particularly disagreed with the boy's judgment, but discipline was discipline. At 713 East 67th Street, Mrs. Barbara Sternan had no sooner plugged in her vacuum cleaner when all the walls on her house turned pink. My lord, she told herself, I've short-circuited the house. Then her pink walls fell in. They were followed by orange flame, and she screamed. She shut her eyes, but not before the flames had seared her eyeballs. At Thomas Edison Field, a good 2 miles away, all the players and spectators looked up. They could feel the heat. Hey, said Harry Robleski to his friend Al Panetta. That must be some fire. Al Panetta nodded. Necks were craned. Harry Robleski estimated that the fire was about 2 blocks away, maybe 3. Probably somebody's furnace blew up, said Al Panetta. By the way, I'm saying this, there's no quotation marks or breaks between anything. It's all just, like I said, black text.
Just one big jumble in your... You know, so these are all people you've been following, kind of, you know, throughout the whole story.
Yeah, so it's all just merged together into this giant blob of information hitting you in the face. And I've read more than I intended to apologize, but I'll finish with this. The explosion had come from one of the spherical tanks at the East Ohio Gas Co. liquefaction plant. It made a sound that was, on the other page, not so much of a boom as a great hollow whoom. Something like the sound a gas oven gives off when you light it. And it goes on for another 2 pages of just hammering you with what is happening all around.
Yeah,
this explosion.
And what the amazing thing is, Morris is cool as a cucumber through this whole thing. He's just, you know, while he's processing what is going on, he's looking around what needs to be done. Not so much, no panic, no real worries. Like, hey, you know, we need to get out of here. Something's going on. I need to save my sister and myself.
Yeah, there's definitely like it like has this huge like panoramic of like this is happening all around us, and then it cuts back straight to Morris, and he somehow survives the initial explosion, like so like it knocks the cart over, and it saves both him and his sister, and like it singes all his hair off, and he's got these weird bald spots that he's like nervous about. It also like fries his pants, so his butt's hanging out.
Yeah, which we learn about a little bit later.
Yeah, and his sister partially catches on fire, and she gets heavily burned, but that's where his jar of peanut butter that he brought with him comes in handy. He starts using that as like a soothing
bomb. Yeah, he finds out that the oils in it can kind of calm the burns down a little bit, the pain of the burns. And
yeah, this is old timey peanut butter where you have to like stir it before you eat it. So it's got this nice oils, and he like applies that to all of her burns, and he starts, rather than like, he's even in, despite his state of shock, he's able to think logically and be like, this, you know, like, my sister needs help, and he helps his sister.
And then he's like, okay, we need to get out of here, and he finds a route to escape where there's just explosions going off all around him and columns of flames all around him. Basically, they're explaining he's in hell right now, and you know, he sees a way out, and he's like, okay, we're just going to start going there, and he's dragging that wagon that he's been dragging all this time and saying how tired he is, and he's just lugging it along, finds a woman.
She's got her face essentially melted off.
Yeah, and instead of leaving her, screaming,
crawling on the floor, there's some really graphic detail of her, like, crawling on knees that have, like, been singed off across asphalt.
Instead of doing what probably most people would do and just leave her for dead, he gets her to the wagon, puts peanut butter on her, and starts dragging her while the sister's pushing. You remember, the sister's, like, 5 years old or 7 years old or something.
Six, yeah. Split the difference.
Yeah. Then he finds the legless guy, helps him, and you said, you know, he's basically dragging all these people behind him, trying to get them to safety.
Yeah, he saves two people who probably would have died because, you know, the man with no legs, he can't get himself out.
Yeah, he's begging for help, and people are running by him, and he almost gets run over by a fire truck. And
yeah, it's almost like a biblical scene with the Good Samaritan where everyone passes by this man who obviously can't save himself, and Morris stops and he helps him and gets him to safety.
Yeah, and basically they get to safety. The burn woman gets sent to the hospital. The legless man gets sent to the hospital, and they're just saying how great this savior is, but no one really knows who he is because Morris and his sister end up in a gymnasium where they're trying to get the survivors together. People realize, hey, these kids don't belong here, and they eventually get a ride home. And basically, that's that. Morris is like, yeah, I did what I had to do. I completed my mission, and now I want to go home. And
yeah, Sandra's like,
I miss my mommy.
Yeah, he feels like he like accomplished something, which he did. Like, he saved two people's lives.
But he's not even thinking about it. He's like, I made it to Stanley's house. It's like, I completed my original mission. He's like, he doesn't even care about the saving of the lives of other people. That's just inconsequential to him.
Yeah. It does have like a weird ending, I gotta say, because he gets gets a little too philosophical at the end with just he's like talking about like what he's gonna do for the rest of his life now, and he's just sitting in the back, like, he's getting a ride home, and he's sitting in the back of the car with his sister, and he's like, onward, ever onward. Got a little silly at the end, but
yeah,
I think he got a little too heavy-handed with it, but that's okay.
Yeah, so it was a good book. And that's basically the story there.
Yeah, that was so.
At times there, you could definitely kind of see Stephen King's style of writing in there.
Yeah, you can definitely see it.
Especially in the conversations.
Dialogue is definitely, you can tell some inspiration behind that. It's like meeting quirky characters that help you or hurt you, and you know, trying to decipher who is who. Like it was very like.
Yeah, so you could definitely see, you know, when Stephen King said that he drew a lot from this author, you could definitely see it. So that was kind of neat. You know, it wasn't just Stephen King, not just a famous author throwing a blurb out for somebody. It was probably legit. Stephen King really likes this book and this author. And
yeah, it's high praise. I'll actually read what he says because it's right on the cover. So, the greatest thing since sliced bread is a brilliant piece of writing, a book to put on the same shelf as Catcher in the Rye and The Outsiders. What was it like to be a kid at mid-century in the Midwest? Read this book and see. And yeah, he compares it to Catcher and The Outsiders, too. Very big.
Personally, I liked it better than Catcher in the Rye. I would have rather read this book than Catcher in the Rye back in ninth grade. I hated that book. Yeah. Like, what's the point of this stupid book?
Yeah, I think if you, like, I mean, you're always going to be able to find books that have, you know, similar structures and storylines. I think a lot of those, you know, getting on my educational high horse, I think a lot of those, you know, mandatory readings can be more, not, I still have them there, but also have other options because there are other ways you can tell the story and more than just, you know, Holden Caulfield's depiction of what life in that era was like.
Because what I think is we need to bring Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman into mandatory reading for school.
I agree with this. especially Neil Gaiman. You should definitely read some Neil Gaiman.
Hey, Terry Pratchett too. I mean, come on.
Yeah, you gotta find room for Pratchett.
The guy's a classic. So yeah, you ready for some questions, Alex?
I sure am. Go for it. Lay it on me.
Question number one: how does the narration reveal the ordinary / extraordinary preoccupations of a 9-year-old boy? Why focus on the boy POV point of view? What are the advantages disadvantages of doing so? So I guess why focus on the 9-year-old in this story instead of one of the adults?
Well, it's always interesting looking through the eyes of a child, because that changes the story. You automatically have an unreliable narrator, and I know this is in third person, omniscient, but you still have to change your brain to be able to process.
Kind of a simplified view of the world. I mean, you look at, he's very black and white with how things are supposed to be.
Yeah, and that's very developmentally appropriate. So Don Robertson does a good job of thinking, how would a 9-year-old approach the situation? Would he be standoffish? Would he put himself in there? Would he know exactly what's happening at all times? And so there are some confusing scenes, like the cigarette riot. You don't really know what that's about until after it's already happened and someone explains it to him.
Yeah, he's explaining it to his sister, and even then it's a lot of the nuance and the details are missing. It's just, this is what people do, especially poor people.
Yeah, and it's a good way to take, complex thoughts and simplify them. Probably when we get into Edward Tulane on the regular episodes, there's going to be a lot of that where you take complex emotions and situations and just heavily simplify it to make it understandable at a child's level.
How does politics, racism, and anti-Semitism intrude on Morris's awareness as a 9-year-old? Why support FDR despite his age? What does his support for FDR and the Democrats mean in a larger sense? So in this book, he's very proud of his FDR pins. He's, his whole family is very big in the Democratic Party, and so he's always, even in school, he's wearing, FDR pins. Vote for FDR, because this would have been his going for his fourth term, I believe, at this time.
Yes.
So it was very controversial back then. I know nowadays we look back at it, it's like, oh, that was a done deal. That was always meant to be, but. If you grew up then, you would realize that, or if you know your history, you knew that that wasn't necessarily the case, that it was a big deal that he was going for a fourth term. When nobody thought you should be going after after a third term, and here he is winning a fourth one. And
yeah, that was such a big deal that he was really the first person to ever do that, run for more than two terms.
The other Roosevelt did. Ran for a third term, but he didn't. He did it as a third party candidate and got trounced.
It was it's the first person ever, I guess, achieved that goal. And very rarely do presidents even attempt to run more than that.
They can't now because after he did it, they made it illegal. But
it was Washington said two terms, and a lot of the majority of presidents were two terms is. It and it was just kind of just an unspoken agreement. So the fact that the Roosevelts had broken that mold, and wanted to make the president being president a lifetime career, that's a big deal. And I usually don't get into politics, but think about 1940s era, FDR was the man. He was guiding us through a war. He was guiding us through the Great Depression.
Did you ever watch? Do you watch any documentaries or the Ken Burns documentaries?
I do not.
Okay, Ken Burns last year came out with a documentary on the Holocaust, and it went really in depth on basically how the world failed the Jewish communities around the world. But he went into a lot of FDR's unpopularity and a lot of his opinions on the Jews, because FDR was very pro saving the Jewish communities in Europe. And I said it really shined a light how, in this book, it hints at the anti-Semitism and the racism in this book, and just how unpopular what FDR, the things FDR was trying to do during the war, said bringing Jews to America, going into this war to begin with. Americans don't realize it now, but at the beginning of World War II, most of America wanted nothing to do with getting into this war.
Yeah, it took Pearl Harbor for it to happen.
Yeah, and it's and even then it was, do we really have to go into Europe? Why don't we just go after Japan? Because they're the ones that did it. Who cares about Europe? And again, for Morris, as a 9-year old, he doesn't understand a lot of this stuff. He doesn't understand the racism towards the black people. Like I said earlier, he barely mentions the color of the skin for the kids that are beating him up. It's kind of heavily hinted in the story. Yeah, these are black kids that went to the black school, and the black lady was their teacher. You know, these kids that dropped out of school or were about to drop out of school. And, you know, he sees the quality of the houses getting worse and worse as he's going across the city. And, you know, that's really the only evidence you have that, yeah, he's going into these really bad neighborhoods that you probably shouldn't be walking through. But, again, you know, Morris doesn't really have any knowledge of it. And he's blindly following what his parents tell him to, are saying for a politician, but people that see him wearing these pins, you're making assumptions about him. You know, essentially, you're like, oh, this kid is for, you know, FDR. He's, you know, he may be a kid, but maybe he knows more than he's letting, you know, than his age would normally say. I said, well, he's just cheering on the guy that his dad votes for.
Yeah, he doesn't really seem to put much thought behind backing FDR. He just, like, yeah, he's got the pin. FDR supported his family, so he's supporting FDR. That's really all there is to it.
Robertson changes the narration style from first person to third and first by page 76. I'll kind of touch on this. How does this shift the impact of the novel's depiction of the explosion?
Yeah, we get the panoramic, the all-encompassing worldview with the third person, and then with the first person we get the individual. How did this impact me? So there's both of it there. He kind of just free flies between both of them, and I think I talked a lot about that with just the jumbled paragraphs and the just pure chaos.
It basically gives you more of a adult view of the explosion too, where, you know, he has really no clue what's going on and he's just seeing his little tiny world of it. We're getting a lot more nuance and the just the tragedy of the explosion because all these people's lives are being so thrown apart.
Yeah, this is like gone in an instant.
Mm-hmm. What is the point of Morris and Sandra seeing June Weed? What does the scene show about their vulnerability?
I don't remember this scene.
So June Weed is the riot, the cigarette riot.
Oh, that's right, the cigarette riot. Okay.
So we get a ton of backstory about June Weed, about how she's the nanny for Morris and Sandra, but basically, you know, because the mom has to get a job because they don't have enough money to have us do what they're, you know, to live in their house anymore. So they're bringing this nanny who basically ignores the children and sends them to their rooms and then invites what they call sailors to the house where she's just having sex with them, which I kind of want to be like, why are there sailors in the middle of the United States where there's no oceans? So I was a little confused on that.
They'll deploy anywhere.
It's like you know, you think they'd be in the coastal cities where there are ships and ocean. So I was a little confused on that part. It's like, shouldn't they be soldiers, not sailors? But
when you're on leave, you just go where they tell you to go. You don't question it.
But anyway, so that's who June Weed is the.
That's right. Okay.
So what's the point of having that whole scene to begin with?
I think it was getting that, like, humanized conversation, like, being like, yeah, she was a prostitute, she did some really awful stuff, but she's also a human being, and she's someone who kind of gives the kids a pass, and she's not this monster that she was portrayed as when she was nannying. She's this complex individual who's struggling in life.
Yeah, I think it kind of had a twofold. It was that showing, you know, humanizing June and just giving a snapshot into that group of people's, this lower income group of people's, you know, struggles during the war. But it also kind of putting pressure on Morris and Sandra, especially knowing that Sandra at any moment could end this whole thing by just saying, hey, we're not supposed to be here. And her willingness to follow her brother through whatever it takes to help him, even though she's kind of the unwilling and unwanted companion on this trip. You know, just kind of tightening their bond from the get-go, because leading up to that point, it's just the two of them antagonizing each other the whole time. And the cops show up and say, you know, there's a bunch of people, you know, starting to question, like, hey, why are these kids even here? And because June is trying to get Morris to buy cigarettes for her so she can get, they're limited to two packs. And she wants to get, she said, hey, Morris, if you buy me these cigarettes, I can get four and get more than everyone else. And
it's fighting for even just, you know, one little creature comfort of two extra packs of cigarettes, which will last you, what, like a day or two?
15 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, smoking four at a time.
Yeah. How does the legless man's description of Morris's actions enable Morris to acknowledge his bravery? How would an event of this magnitude leave its mark on Morris and his sense of self?
It's an event that would cause deep trauma in a child. I think
most children, you think about, they would be PTSD'd through the roof and basically frozen.
Yeah, so like in the beginning of the book where he says like he felt like his greatest accomplishment was seeing Stanley right before the explosion happened. Obviously, his greatest accomplishment is saving two people's lives. I think the legless man's words is kind of like what brings him around to that. Being like, he's had all this self-doubt throughout this entire book about who he is as a person. Is he good? Is he evil? Is he a coward? And hearing somebody call him the greatest thing since sliced bread brings him to around and be like, maybe I'm, you know, more complex than that. Maybe I'm a lot of things. And maybe I really am this brave person who is capable of doing anything I set my mind to, because I kept my head in this situation, I saved people's lives, and maybe I am a good thing.
I think initially Morris is kind of just shrugs it off, like, this guy's kind of a Looney Tune. You know, I don't know why he's getting all hot and bothered about what I did. I just did what I was supposed to do. I think it's one of those things where maybe looking back a year or 5 years, he'll start to realize what he did. But I think in the moment, he just kind of, okay, whatever. I just did what anyone would do, even though we get the picture that no one else was doing what he was doing.
Yeah.
Also, like even the, you know, you get the, in the chaos, you get the sense that the firefighters don't even know what to do. They're just running around in a panic. And because you got fire trucks crashing and, you know, falling through the streets and just them running around like madmen, you know, running over people. And
yeah. So the car gets destroyed because it gets run over by a fire truck.
Yeah.
But like Morris is obviously in a deep state of shock when he's doing a lot of these things. It becomes very just like, apply the peanut butter. Simple tasks, like apply the peanut butter, get her in the cart, tell my sister to hold her up. I wonder what happened to Stanley Chalupka. Like he keeps repeating that, but just like coming back to it, like he's trying to do these tasks, but his mind's reverting back to like, what happened to him? What happened to him? It's like this repetition, and it almost replaces the, there's like this beautiful repetition of the cart going tiddle-ump across the street, and then it's replaced by him going, I wonder what happened to Stanley Chalupka.
Or wondering why there's laughing behind him every time he starts pulling the cart.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He has his pants burn away. Yeah, his butt's hanging out. So he's got to, like, pause what he's doing, get his coat back from his sister, tie it around his waist so people can't look at his butt while he's doing his thing.
This was written during Vietnam. It was published in 65, so...
Right at the beginning of Vietnam.
Yeah, right when the public awareness of Vietnam. To what extent was the political climate influencing the author? Does it change your perspective of the major themes? Personally, I don't think it affected much because trying to write books, and as you know, Alex, oftentimes the writing is a multi-year long process. So I don't think, and you know, you said this was published at the very beginning of the public awareness of Vietnam, and while people that were acutely aware of what was going on would have known before, the sour look and feel in Vietnam, you know, you're still a few years away from that. So you're still in the rah-rah-rah of World War II, and, you know, so Korea hadn't really sunk in.
Yeah, I don't think the anti-Vietnam sentiment had fully sunk in when this book came out. I could be talking completely out of my ass here, but I think Vietnam was, you know, the first really televised war. Korea had its moments, and it was...
people didn't really know about Korea. I mean, they knew what was going on, but they didn't know the details or how bad it was. It wasn't until Vietnam where they realized, oh, no, this is what war looks like. Okay, this is not what we want.
Because like, it used to be like you had to go to a movie theater and watch a propaganda film on World War II. And just, I think he does more just the sentiment of 1940s era. Like, there is a war on. We all need to make sacrifices. And just that general mindset that got us through the war during those years. I didn't really see a whole lot of anti-war sentiment coming from, you know, the impact of Vietnam 20 years later when he wrote this.
Yeah, no, I didn't either. And
not to say that Don Robertson supported the war, but he probably lived through it.
Don Robertson grew up during World War II era. He would have been around, I think, a little bit older than Morris's age when during World War II, if I remember correctly.
He was born in 29.
Okay, so he would have been way older.
44, yeah. He would have been a young man by then.
Yeah. But he's still impressionable during World War II and might have even possibly served in some capacity at that age. Yeah, so I got these questions from HarperCollins.com just so we can...
Really dug deep.
Yeah, I dug deep. It was from a book club.
We're about an hour and 10 just seeing it.
I don't care. We got 5 hours to go, Alex. Just buckle down, get ready.
Hey, you got to work in the morning, huh?
My final question here. So as we've mentioned a few times, this book greatly influenced Stephen King. But as we've also said, from our generation, most of us have never even heard of this author, let alone any of his books. Apparently, one of his books was turned into a movie in the 90s with, what's his face, the Darth Vader voice?
James Earl Jones?
James Earl Jones was in it. And it was off of, another book that was based off of Morris. Didn't know about it. But I guess it says, what is it to say, that this book is basically a forgotten classic, as Stephen King would put it. What does it say about great literary works and their staying power through the generations? How these books just kind of fade away into nothing, and, how books are, what books, survive, a lot longer. Say, like, what's the difference between this book and Catcher in the Rye, or... Why was Catcher in the Rye picked for being read in high school versus this book? Why are we still reading... What's his face there?
There's a lot of guys with faces.
and Juliet.
Talking about Shakespeare?
Yes. Why are we reading Shakespeare?
I was actually going to bring him up in my answer, but... Yeah.
Okay. Versus how many... there were plenty of playwrights back then that probably had even better... just as good plays, but, we have no knowledge of them anymore.
Yeah, it's almost there's just so much out there, and there's more books published every year than anyone could probably ever read in their lifetime. So, like, the people living in the now do not get to decide what is going to be widely read in the future. Shakespeare has obviously had his staying power. He was not well received in his time.
1500s.
Yeah, 1500s, but yet 600 years later, we're still reading him. His plays were found to be more accessible because he wrote for the common man, and the common man are the people that held onto their books and they held onto the folios, and his plays endured while other more renowned playwrights of that time faded away into obscurity, are either unread, obscure, or just completely forgotten. And we see that in almost every area of literature, like even going back to, the Canterbury Tales, or original books like Epic of Gilgamesh. Like, they get lost, they get unread, people abandon them. There's just so much being thrown at you, and, like, especially nowadays when there are so many people, like, everyone's got a book, everyone's got a screenplay, everyone's got a play they want to push. And so figuring out who is going to get read and who isn't, who's going to endure and who isn't, is up to the people of the future, and they're going to choose it recklessly and, or not recklessly, but just without consideration, really, to who sells the most copies. So, like, I don't know if Stephen King going to be read 500 years from now.
I think Stephen King's going to have a lot more staying power than Don Robertson.
He's reached a wider audience. I agree.
And just the fact that, his movies and books are always top sellers. I think, he has probably a better chance of sticking around for a few hundred years anyways. And
yeah, he's I think he's hit a point where he's like almost like Charles Dickens. Obviously, like, he was a voice of a generation, not to take anything away from him, but he also sold incredibly well. He's like one of the original, like, celebrity novelists, and has carried now for 200 years.
I always think, like, what about, like, Terry Pratchett, who probably will have written just as many books as Stephen King has. Yeah, boy, by the time Stephen King finally passes away. And I personally prefer Terry Pratchett books. I find them hilarious. But he will probably not last as long as Stephen King's name, even though they probably should be on equal footing, at least, even, you know, just different genres.
Yeah, there's a lot of writers, once they pass away, and there's usually a big surge of sales in their books, and then it falls off precipitously. And Pratchett, especially in like England, like he's still this beloved icon of English literature, but especially humor. And it's hard to say if he'll make it or not. I mean, you look at, even like Moby Dick tanked on its release, and Herman Melville never really got to enjoy success during his lifetime. It wasn't until after he died that people rediscovered it, kind of like the greatest thing since sliced bread. Rediscover an American classic. That's what happened to Moby Dick, and now it's very widely read, and it's a very well-known story.
What I always enjoy, all these New York Times bestsellers, you know, sell thousands of copies. I mean, let's face it, you know, most books only sell a few thousand copies to be a bestseller. But then once they drop off that list because something new came in, they're never read again. Yeah. They're just forgotten. Yeah. They're, you know,
a lot of these bargain bins. A lot of these authors, well, you know, they have dozens, and some authors even get into the hundreds of books. You are lucky if you have even one work that endures for any length of time. Look at Joseph Heller. He wrote, I think, 9 books in his lifetime, but people only read Catch 22. I'm trying to think of another example off the top of my head.
Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange, yeah. That was a complete and total
throwaway novel for him.
Yeah, it was a throwaway. He wrote it, pumped it out in 3 weeks for money. He thought it'd be completely forgotten in, you know, the matter of a year, and now it's his best-known book.
Yeah.
And it's, like, really the only one anyone ever talks about, even though he always had other books that he held in higher regard. Yeah, there's really no say to what's going to just vibe with the public. So there's a lot of that. Yeah.
So final thoughts on the book, Alex? Any final comments?
Well, I gave it 4 stars overall. Does tend
Samesies.
To, yeah, it's a for a shorter book, it does tend to ramble and drag here and there. There are parts where it was starting to lose me, like especially like the whole setup for the quest. I'm like, I'm 40 pages in and you're just jumping from topic to topic kind of willy-nilly, but it all ties together at the end, and I think that's why I was singing such high praise for it, because yeah, that explosion goes off and you're like, whoa. And there's some really good tense action, like edgy. You see, like, the last 60 pages go by so fast because it just becomes this amazing action story that like sucks you right in. So He takes a long time to set it up. It's almost a little frustrating here and there, but he pulls it out at the end. And so he saves it at the end with his excellent writing style.
Yeah, I agree. I think the super long paragraphs, even though it's kind of became a little tedious after, you know, when you're 10th page and you only had 2 paragraphs, 3 paragraphs, and you're like, yeah, especially when you want just like, hey, I need to put this book down, but I have nowhere to, you know, no stopping point here. You're forced to keep going, and
yeah, there are no chapters in this book. It's all just a continuous thing.
Yes, but yeah,
like little section breaks.
Yes, a solid 4 out of 5 stars, I thought. So, I enjoyed the book. Thanks to our listener for suggesting this. I know they wanted to remain nameless, but yeah, thank you for.
I'd be nameless too if I could.
Yeah, you are nameless, Alex. Your face is nameless.
You got me.
Now that horrible zinger is passed, let's wrap this up.
All right. Well, check out all of our social medias, which Joe is going to tell us right now.
Yeah, we have a Gmail account if you want to email us at kendallbookworms@gmail.com.
If you want to make a request,
we'll definitely consider all things heavily. You know, we are looking for more bonus episodes, so please participate in forcing us to read either good books or bad books, as our friend Adam made us do, or Alex with your smut book.
We don't want to do any work, so just send us stuff and we'll read it. It's fine.
We are on Instagram. You can also DM us there. We're at Kendall Bookworms. We are found on Podbean. We're hosted through Podbean. We're on all major podcast apps, so hit us up through any of those. I usually post up questions or polls on Spotify, so if you want to participate on those, you know, check us out there. We have a YouTube channel. Woo-woo.
Yeah.
It's just the audio, no actual video, but if that's your preferred listening, we are now there. All of our episodes have been posted on that.
Yeah, I would have done video, but I can't see the buttons through my hair.
Yeah. It's pretty scary. You would have had nightmares if you had to see Alex's hair. And your mind's getting a little long. It's a little hippie-ish. It's about an inch long right now, three-quarters of an inch. It'll get shaved off.
Insert joke here.
It's kind of turning clownish as it does.
And gray.
And gray, yeah. I'm old. You'll be old soon, too, Alex. see, what else have we got? Anything? You got Alex's book that he's put the new edition out.
Paul Plimpton versus Ragnarok.
Find it on Amazon. Typos. Yeah, find it on Amazon. It'll be in our a link in the description for this episode.
You won't be disappointed.
What else do we got? Anything? Nothing? I think that's it.
I think that's it. So that means, until next time, I'm Alex.
And I'm Joe.
And this has been Bookworms.
Out.